Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and thank you for coming here in person. And thanks also, thank you to these listeners and viewers watching this panel virtually. My name is Miles Yu. I'm a senior fellow and director of the China Center here at the Hudson Institute. It is my pleasure to welcome you here all and to a very exciting discussion about today's event. It's going to be called Understanding China's Political and Institutional Foundations. And our honor guest is very well known, particularly in the Chinese-speaking world. His name is Xu Chenggang. Dr. Xu is from Stanford University, that very prestigious institution on the West Coast. When we talk about the fundamentals, foundations of a government, we talk about the United States, we often say, you know, U.S. is governed by some fundamental founding creeds that would include something like all men are created equal and government by the consent of the governed and popular sovereignty, some very basic things that govern the country for over 250 years. When we talk about China, however, there's a lot of ambiguities and a lot of opacity. Big questions such as, is China still a communist country? How are we going to compete with China, right? The very concept of competition with China is problematic because competition assumes that our competitors embodies all the qualifications of even being in the free market system to compete. That's number one. Number two, the word competition also implies a regime like China will follow the same rules of the competition like we all do. And the reality is very different. That kind of conceptual ambiguity, opacity, has got us into a lot of trouble because we don't understand the fundamentals of the Chinese Communist Party and the rest of the world. So today, to help us understand all this in a much more erudite and articulated way is Professor Xu Chenggang. And his talk will focus on the origin and dangers of China's political system and historical institutions under the Chinese Communist Party. To face China challenge, the United States and its allies need a better understanding of the CCP's origins. How has the CCP maintained legitimacy and control while simultaneously pursuing market reforms and private sector development? How has the party overcome geographic and historical challenges to maintain its centralized control over ideology? So Professor Xu also just published a book, which I encourage you all to buy, and it's called Institutional Genes, subtitle, The Origin of China's Institutions and Totalitarianism. In his book, Professor Xu argues that China is not merely authoritarian, but basically totalitarian. There's a difference between the two. And the system is rooted in the Soviet model and reinforced by China's imperial legacies. The CCP has historically consolidated power through violent campaigns of oppression and has ingrained this institutional legitimacy to control all aspects of political, economic, and social life. So that makes the whole system not just totalitarian, it's a very, very harsh totalitarian. To mischaracterize China's political order presents strategic risks and challenges for the U.S. and allies looking to respond to China's global aspirations and ambitions. Professor Xu is a senior research scholar at the Stanford Center on China's Economy and Institutions. He's a visiting fellow at the Hoover Institution at Stanford University. He's also a visiting professor at the Imperial College in London. Prior to this, he taught at the University of Hong Kong, Tsinghua University, and the London School of Economics, as well as serving as president of Asian Law and Economics Association. His research focuses on primarily in politics and institutional economics and Chinese political economy. So the format of today's discussion will begin with a keynote from our guest, Professor Xu, and that will run about 15 to 20 minutes, and followed by a conversation between myself and Professor Xu. Time permitting, and we'll have questions and answers from our audience here today. Without further ado, I'd like to welcome to the podium Professor Chen Gangxu.
Thank you so much, Miles, for inviting me here to have a chance to share my views with the audience. Indeed, as Miles just mentioned, that in the United States, many things are taken for granted, such as human rights, such as participation by the voters. But here, when we talk about China, there are many deep misunderstandings about China. So what is taken for granted among the Chinese? So people actually don't know. And many travelers, when they travel to China, they don't know what are the things, the very fundamental things, which are taken for granted among the Chinese. So the most important thing that taken for granted is that the Communist Party leads everything. And that is actually the definition of totalitarianism. So let's start from this discussion. Let me just very quickly to have an overview about the reason I'm talking about the book, because I have only 15 minutes, but the lots of information is there. So here, a key issue in economics and also when we talk about institution is how institutions change. And the reason here we mention this issue is because totalitarianism is not originated from China. It was originated from Russia. And it was Russian, it was the Soviet Union implanted this institution to China. But then the question is why they succeeded in China, but they failed in many other places. The biggest success of Soviet Union was to implant this institution into China. And that lasted that long, it's so persistent in China. So we have to address that issue. For addressing that issue in economics, there is a very famous theory by Douglas North called path dependence, which argues that the way history change, the way institutions change follows their path. So then if we look at the path in China, then China actually, before implementing this totalitarian regime, China had a longest history of empire, as an empire. The Chinese empire is quite unique. So then we have this question, why is the path dependent? So then here I try to address that issue by inventing a concept called institutional genes, which are the very basic fundamental institutional elements. And these elements are actually quite persistent. So even on the surface, things are changed. On the surface, you could have revolutions, but the underlying institutional genes are quite persistent. So I try to explain why, how the Soviet succeeded in China in that particular way. And also, in 1946, this famous economist, von Mises, gave a warning. So right after right after the ending of the Second World War, the warning is that totalitarianism is winning. So our efforts of containing totalitarianism have been failed. And today, this is actually even more so. So if we look at the rise of the communist totalitarianism, then you see that the major rise was in the 1950s, 60s, and then now. So the how comes this particular type of system becomes a superpower, right? So in the 50s, 60s, 70s, Soviet Union became the superpower. And today, the Chinese Communists became a superpower. And all of these are deeply related to what von Mises said, that we all failed. We failed in containing totalitarianism. And a very fundamental part of this failing is the failure in understanding. So when people don't recognize this is a totalitarianism, when people don't recognize the threat from this, then we fail. And then finally, I try to explain what make the Chinese totalitarianism different from Soviet Union. So the number one difference is that in around 1989 to 91, all communist regimes in Soviet Union and Central Eastern Europe all collapsed. And at that time, the Chinese communist was deeply worried, but they survived. How comes? So why they survived? Not only they survived, they actually were invited by the United States for all the benefits. That is the way it becomes a superpower. So then we want to understand what happened in China. Right. So there is a key conceptual issue, which is a authoritarianism vis-a-vis totalitarianism. The reason here we emphasize the difference between the two is because once you don't understand the difference between the two, and then this conceptual misunderstanding is going to lead huge mistakes in policies. For example, in political science, there is a very famous theory about how an authoritarian regime can be transferred into democratic capitalism through economic development. So it's called modernization theory. And when people believe that, when they don't distinguish between an authoritarian regime and a totalitarian regime, then you make the fundamental mistake. So take Taiwan as example. So before 1988, Taiwan was an authoritarian regime. So when people thought that the People's Republic of China was an authoritarian regime in the 90s and the early 21st century, they just confused the nature of the system. So they thought if Taiwan could change from authoritarian to a democratic capitalism, if South Korea could do it, why not China? But that is a mistake. Conceptually, that is a mistake. So what is a totalitarianism? Totalitarianism, so in a very short way of defining that, this is a one-party system. The party controls everything. And here, the key issue is that this party is not a political party. This is very important. So don't confuse Communist Party with a Republican Party or a Democratic Party. It's not. So the reason it's not is because this party does not allow the existence of any other organizations outside of this party. And this party does not allow, even internally, any political factions. So any formal political faction is illegal, is going to be eliminated. So this is not a party. This is a key understanding. And when they are doing things internally in that way, what they are doing internationally, then you can infer. It's easily to infer what they are doing. So when we talk about the competition, what is the competition? So here, indeed, there is a competition, but the competition is not commerce, it's not business, it's not market. This is a competition of two systems. So that kind of a competition actually, at least officially announced In 1956, if my memory is correct, Khrushchev made an announcement in the UN. So that is the competition. So that sort of a competition. And the communists knew it, know it very well. And everything they are doing is within their united front strategy. How many minutes I left? Okay, so this is a summary of my explanation about how the Chinese institutions evolved. And as I mentioned earlier, that the Chinese Empire is the longest living empire on Earth. So more than 2,000 years. And when we talk about the institutional genes, so in the book, I discussed how the institutional genes of the imperial system emerged and evolved, and why the Chinese Empire could last that long. So this long living actually itself is important. So there are key elements being inherited in today's institution. And then this communist totalitarian institution is exogenous. It comes from Soviet Union. So that is a shock to the Chinese. But here the key issue is that the two types of institutional genes, the institutional genes inherited internally and institutional genes implanted into China combined together, and then the birth of the communist regime in China, officially starting from 1949, but actually started from 1931. So in 1931, the communist established this Chinese Soviet Republic. So just like Ukraine or any other republics within Soviet Union. So they established a Soviet Republic in China. But then here, a key thing happened in 1958, which actually the Chinese deviated from the Soviet model, changing from a classic totalitarian regime into what I called regionally administered totalitarianism. So here, the key difference between the Chinese way of governing a totalitarian regime from Soviet way is that so they actually give a huge amount of administrative and economic side, those kind of tasks assigned to the local authorities. So when we use the term regional or local, we are talking about the provincial level, city level, county level, township level. So at all levels, and that actually substantially differentiates from Soviet Union. But this major change is a huge shock, internal shock. This major change is at a cost. The cost is about 40 million people died of the Great Famine. That's the Great Leap Forward. And also the Cultural Revolution. In the Cultural Revolution, 100 million people were purged. So according to the Chinese Communist Party's statistics. And then here, the reason we talk about this regionally administered totalitarianism is because this is today's regime. So when the economic reform started, it started from this kind of institution. And that kind of institution is different from the way Soviet managed. And within this kind of arrangement, you have a total party control over strategic issues. The strategic issues would include personnel and also ideology and party line. And so all the appointments are strictly top-down. So through appointments and promotion, demotion, and also party discipline, through all of these channels, they make sure that everything is under their control strategically. But tactically, it's much more flexible. So then for the purpose of surviving, they shifted their objective from class struggles into economic growth. But the way of achieving this is through regional competition. This is because the regions have already obtained quite strong administrative and economic resources. And so the whole economy has been managed through regional authorities instead of central ministries. So this is the key difference. And through this regional competition, many of the local authorities, for the sake of getting promotion, for the sake of winning the competition against other regions, they actually protect the private business within their jurisdictions. So this is actually the beginning of privatization, although privatization as a term is banned in China, has been banned, including today, so always banned. So no one is allowed to talk about privatization within China, but in fact, they privatized. And this privatization is disguised. So they cheat their bosses. And their bosses are also very happy to be cheated. So every level of the bosses are happy to be cheated. Through that way, they privatized in the 1990s and in the early 21st century. And then, so this is the way they survived. And through that channel, they also merged into the global trading system, being invited to join WTO and enjoy the favorable conditions, favorable trading conditions with the United States, and also attract the foreign direct investments. They are telling democracies that they are on right track, and the people believed them. But actually, the Communist Party has been highly alerted about the danger of capitalism. And that is actually the reason that the whole thing reversed. The reason the whole thing is reversed in the recent decade is because they found the growth of the private sector and the civil society associated with the private sector and also with the NGOs abroad. They found that these are the true threats. They are going to shake up the foundation of the party rule. So that actually is the fundamental reason that the whole thing reversed. And now, when China becomes a superpower driven by, I'm finishing. when China is driven by the private sector and also by multinational corporations in China, so then they become a superpower, then they have sufficient resources spending into military. And the threat becomes much more explicit, much more obvious. So, but then here, my key point is that understanding the nature of the Chinese communist regime is the key before any discussions, any debates about foreign policy. Okay, I should stop here. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Xu, for that illuminating keynote. And I think, you know, when we talk about the U.S. foreign policy, we're always trying to sort of transcend the trivia. And when I mean trivia, we're talking about the policies, and policy is not trivia, but policy can be very mutable. You can change from administration to administration. Even within administration, policy can change quite frequently. So we normally will feel happy that we look at the first principle. First principle, basically the most fundamental aspect of any bilateral relationship. So I'm so glad that you mentioned about some of the fundamentals Particularly striking is the important distinction between authoritarianism and totalitarianism. For any American tourist to go to China, you see skyscrapers, you see high-speed rail, and so they will be sort of impressed by that. But you point out the internal control mechanism, the particular the command economy, that part is very important. Now, I was struck by your insistence on the Chinese totalitarianism is implanted from Russia, which is absolutely true. But also, you mentioned the concept of the institutional genes. Now, when you talk about genes, that's something very sort of indigenous, something that's very rooted in Chinese tradition. Right. So how do you reconcile this implanted totalitarianism right. versus Chinese traditional sort of indigenous institutions?
Right. So here, I guess to address this issue, we have to first look at what are the institutional genes of a communist regime. So the core of the communist regime in Soviet Union is the Soviet Communist Party, Bolshevik. So the institutional, I decomposed the institutional genes of the Bolshevik. So there are three elements. So the element number one is the Tsarist imperial system. The element number two is the secretive political organizations, which these political secretive political organizations, they call themselves as a terrorist organizations. So this is not a label by historians. They call themselves in that way. The number three element is the Russian Orthodox Church, Russian Orthodoxy. So three elements. Since I don't have time, I cannot elaborate. Among the three, Chinese shared two. The Chinese imperial system and the Russian imperial system are very close. So they shared that part. And in terms of secretive political organizations, China had a much longer history and much deeper root in that aspect as well. So the only thing missing in China is the orthodoxy. And so that is imported. That's imported so that's the Comintern. Comintern is a missionary agency of the Soviet Communist Party. And this missionary agency brought this to China and trained the Chinese. And also they trained the Chinese communists how to do the propaganda, how to incite the mass. And many of those key elements are actually originally adopted from Russian orthodoxy. So when the Chinese shared two of the key institutional genes, only one need to be imported. That make a much easier for the communists to succeed in China. Okay. They also tried in Germany, but they failed. So because they shared too little.
Yeah. So that's a very, very important aspect of this whole topic. That is, you just explained with great clarity the institutional aspect of this transplantation of Marxist-Leninism. But Marxist-Leninism, to me, as a historian, is first and foremost an ideology.
Right.
Marxist-Leninism ideology that on surface is very attractive
right.
because it appeals to the people who are seeking solutions to ending all suffering.
Right.
Because the promise, the utopian version
right.
Of the future world.
Right.
And speaking of which, that's what I think, you know, in addition to the institutional connection, there's also the ideological connection of traditional Chinese ideology. Well, what is Chinese traditional ideology? Anybody who knows Chinese medicine, you will know. When you see a doctor in a Chinese hospital, if it's Chinese traditional medicine, the doctor will ask you, okay, they don't ask you about your symptoms. If you see a Western doctor, they say, okay, you have a headache, okay, take Tylenol. Or have surgery, remove something. The Chinese doctor will say, there's a whole system that's wrong. There's something inside your body totally out of balance. So they try to seek solution from the roots. What's the roots of Chinese system? In this political arena, it's the utopianism. China in the 19th century, early 20th century, believed the Chinese whole system was in crisis. And they're desperate seeking to a cure-all solution. And that's where the Chinese utopianism, trying to find a solution from the Tixi point of view, systemic point of view, that's where Marxism came in. That's how the two, in addition to institutional sort of affinity, they also have this kind of ideological affinity, because the Chinese Communist Party right now is really based upon a lot of utopian promises over there, and they'd like to do some kind of landmark project, like the skyscrapers, like the high-speed trail railways, not based on market principle, not for profitability, but just for to fulfill the grandiose promise of utopianism. And you can see a lot of high scrapers in China were not occupied, and high-speed rail systems losing money big time. So, but anyway, back to that. So Marxism-Leninism, to what degree the Chinese Communist Party's policy is guided by the theories of Marxism-Leninism in today's China?
Right. Yeah, talking about the Marxist-Leninist ideology, if we look at the original ideology, actually is transformed from Christianity. In my book, I have a whole chapter discussing how this is transformed from Christianity, the Reformation, and then changing from Christian communism into secular communism, and then become a brutal, violent revolution. So I have this discussion. And here, but in terms of ideology, really the key thing in terms of being implemented in the regime is the idea of dictatorship of proletariat, which was invented by Karl Marx. And when Karl Marx invented this concept in his later years, so many people were talking about the great contributions of Karl Marx, but he made it clear by himself. He said, actually, my greatest invention is the dictatorship of proletariat. So what is that? The dictatorship of proletariat itself means totalitarianism. So the core content of the dictatorship of proletariat, so how that was invented, what's the purpose of inventing that? The purpose of inventing that is when Karl Marx was trying to give practical guidance to the communists in Germany. So then he said, the whole thing had to start from this particular type of dictatorship. By using the violence, you confiscate private properties, and using this dictatorship to rule, to eliminate private property rights, and then to keep the order, and then you transform into communism. So before achieving communism, the first step, you have to go through this step. And it was Lenin invented a concrete organization called the Communist Party to implement the so-called dictatorship of a proletariat. So either the Communist Party represents a proletariat or not, it doesn't matter. What matters is the dictatorship of the Communist Party in the name of proletariat.
Yeah, that's a very good answer. Of course, Lenin literally was the founder of Chinese Communist Party, because right. In 1921, he sent the agents of Comintern from today's, Indonesia, which yeah. then was called Dutch East India, to Shanghai to help funding the Chinese Communist Party as a branch, as a China branch of the Comintern, which you referred to earlier.
Right. Also, if we look at today's Constitution of the People's Republic of China and also the Constitution of the Communist Party. So in all of, in two of these constitutions, this dictatorship of proletariat is there. So this is the fundamental principle of ruling China. Of course, the Chinese communists changed the wording. They call that as a democratic dictatorship instead of the people's democratic dictatorship instead of a dictatorship of proletariat.
Yeah, in the same way as the North Korean called itself officially,
yes,
the People's Democratic Republic of Korea. It's focused on people and it's very democratic, of course, yeah. So in your in my study of your thoughts and your books, and come with a term that you coined, which is interesting, is the RATD, which stands for Regionally Administered Totalitarianism. Could you shed more light on that?
Right. So here, the key is that, first of all, it's a totalitarianism. So it's the same, the Chinese totalitarian regime is the same as the Soviet totalitarian regime in the sense of a one-party system, in the sense that the Communist Party controls everything. But the way the Chinese Communist Party controls China is different from the way the Soviet Communist Party controls the Soviet Union. So the key difference is that instead of relying on central ministries, here in China, they rely on regional authorities. So you have a provincial level, city level, county level, township level. At all the levels, you have the party penetrates everywhere, and the party is a strictly top-down organization implementing the party line and following the party guidance. And also, the appointment is controlled top-down. But in terms of tactical issues, how to solve problems is quite decentralized. So through this decentralization, actually the Chinese Communist Party has been very, very smart. So one of the key issues in Soviet Union is incentives. So they don't have incentives. The bureaucrats don't have incentives. So when Gorbachev wants to do something, Gorbachev was not able to provide incentives to lead the bureaucrats to implement. But the Chinese used the regional competition to solve their incentive problems. So the regional authorities compete each other to fulfill the party strategic goal. So then, not only for the strict internal controls, but also for everything, so including the green energy, including the electrical vehicles, everything. So the reason nowadays you find the overcapacity is such a unsolvable issue is exactly that is the consequence of that kind of a tough competition within. So you have province against the province, city against the city, county against the county. But here, remember, this is not market competition. It's different from market competition. And here, not only you have this regional authorities competing each other, you also have a huge amount of regional resources, state resources. So these resources are divided at different levels. And at each level, they have their resources. They have quite sort of autonomy as long as they follow the party line. And so then they use the resources, and then they borrow. They borrow hugely. So all the deep troubles in China are related to this kind of a mechanism. And also, when some people praise how great China is, how great achievements they can achieve, they don't look at this side. They don't look at the mechanisms. What is driving the whole thing? So the whole thing is actually not a market competition.
Yeah, the macabre side of that is, if you know anything about history of PRC, is the party secretaries whose promotion, whose livelihood entirely depends upon following the party line strictly. In 1959, 1962, between these two several years, there was a huge famine in China. People say famine normally caused by lack of food, mostly caused by that kind of internal competition system, because no party secretary could possibly admit there is a famine, there is a policy failure in his own province, his own turf, because that means his political life will be finished. So as a result, it's a cover-up of this horrendous famine and that caused the lives of tens of millions of Chinese people. So neighboring provinces may have plenty of food,
right.
Grain, to save the province in crisis, but then no party secretary would allow that to happen. So this is actually a very, very important institutional failure, in my view. And you mentioned about this this totalitarian aspect of that, and that's very important. Here in Washington, D.C., I have some colleagues from other think tanks who routinely engage with China scholars from China. They come here to talk about China's situation and how different it is. And it's basically, for me, it's exercising futility, because nobody from China in that totalitarian regime can voice any different voice publicly without getting punished. So as long as we're dealing with the totalitarian regime of that kind, and no matter how suave the scholars are from mainland China, as long as they cannot really voice their opinions openly, that is different from the voice of the government, and then there's no use. That's one of the reasons dilemma is facing a lot of Chinese students here too. You see the Chinese student body here mounting to about 300,000 each year on average, and very few of them are willing to go on record to be critical of the regime, of any aspect of Chinese society. So those who are very vocal normally are the voices condoned and approved by the Chinese Communist Party. So this is a very, very serious issue that really is a sort of eroding the free exchange of market, the market of free exchange of ideas in this country. So to understand that totalitarian aspect of a Chinese regime is absolutely important in my view. Well, thank you very much for adding ammo to that argument. RATD, regionally administered totalitarianism, and strategic ambiguity. You mentioned that this RATD created strategic ambiguity in China's international behavior and domestic politics. Could you elaborate on that more?
Right. Okay. So here, actually, when we look at when we try to understand their strategies in foreign policy, a key issue is the first key issue is to understand that this is a totalitarian party, and the nature of the totalitarian regime is expansionary, and they have a very long view. And so through this very long view, so they look at the long run, they look at the decades in the future. So how to serve for their purpose? So everything they have a grand strategic plan. And then concretely, the major approach is the united front. By the way, United Front, United Front was an invention of Lenin. It's not Chinese. But nowadays, Russians don't remember this anymore. So the Chinese thought that was an invention of Mao Zedong. But actually, from the first day, the Chinese Communist Party was created by Soviet Communist. United Front strategy was already there. So at the very beginning, the Soviet Union designed to have this. So in this kind of strategy, the Chinese Communists had to grow together with the Kuomintang and the KMT in Taiwan. So nowadays in Taiwan. So at that day, so that was the United Front strategy. And so basically, they tried to use the KMT as an instrument to help the communists. And then in the war, Actually, the whole war was financed and designed by the Soviet Red Army. But the idea is that after winning the war, the communist is going to take over, to take over the KMT. But the whole thing failed. But here, there is a huge lesson to learn. Today, the Chinese Communist Party is continuing the same strategy. And who is going to be the KMT? So the KMT is everyone else. So the no matter is the Republican Party or Democratic Party, the White House, the State Department, the corporations, all corporations, everything useful. So everyone, scholars, professors, everyone is a target of this United Front strategy.
Yeah.
And so using this strategy, they are going to portray themselves in a different image. And then people get confused. So people trust them, trust what they are saying, but you don't look at what is in their party line and what is in their constitution.
Yeah. To reinforce your point, you know, Mao Zedong, after the Communist Party took over China, he summarized three magic weapons as to why
right.
Communist Party won.
Right.
Number one is United Front.
Right.
Number two is armed struggle. Number three is a party construction, the building
right.
parties
right.
branches everywhere.
Right.
So that's why United Front is very important. What is United Front? United Front basically is to use the Communist Party's false narrative, conceptual ambiguity, opacity, and to manipulate as well as bamboozle your enemy. And that is a practice of with supreme efficiency in the West, particularly in Washington, D.C. So one of the first tasks that the Trump first term was to basically to focus on the United Front effort in this country. They penetrated not just the elite, but also the local and state governments, and through all kinds of organizations. So that's why United Front is very important. It's a part of the totalitarian regime function. With that, I think we have a few minutes left, and I'd like to turn to the audience for your questions. Okay, go over there. Please identify yourself.
American Legion. Oh, hi, Jeff Steele, the American Legion. Two quick questions. Public versus private discussions. Okay, I get that official scholars can't publicly speak, but quietly in private discussions, do they speak such that there is some bilateral, even if it's submerged? Second question. No, I'll just stick with that question. Thank you.
Right. Private can be different, but still here there is a issue of understanding. So understanding the nature of the nature of the totalitarian regime is not easy. So then among Chinese scholars, not many have a clear understanding that this regime, the nature of the regime, is a totalitarian. So very few. So they can, so privately, most of them are going to complain. And some can complain bitterly and even hatred. But it doesn't mean that when they complain, doesn't mean that they understand the nature of the regime.
I will add to that, it depends on who the person who's privately complaining about. Complaining privately, if you're a senior official, can be deadly and very dangerous. So that's one reason, that's one of the lessons of Qin Gang and Wei Shangfu, all those guys, and even Fang Fenghui, all the people were purged. If you notice that, they're all sort of associated with some kind of recent trip overseas, to the United States in particular. and they have some kind of separate meetings with some people. So Chinese Communist Party top leadership is totalitarian, but also paranoid. They really fear about the internal dissent. So that's one reason is people who complain to you privately, normally I think there are people of less insignificance. They're out of power. When they're back in power, they're just as hardline as they have been. Secondly, I think they are trying to cultivate the image that somehow there is a space for internal dissent in China, privately, that is. I'm not doubting the sincerity of many people who have been totally fed up with this regime. It's just that the government does not have the political culture that will allow you to express views privately. And again, talking to a foreigner can be deadly. Who knows that you're not turning me in? You might not just come to the forum like this and say, so and so told me what I want. So, and then that be the end of his career. Any other questions? Yes, please.
Hi, Professor. I'm a big fan of your work. It's probably like one of the most influential books, like the totalitarian, Origin of Totalitarian, like of Hannah Arendt and Isaiah Berlin, and this is like the China version. So I'm really thankful that Miles, you had invited you to speak here. I also just wanted to kind of go back into what you were saying about how the American or the world understanding of China, or just generally, that it could open up based on economics, trade with China, is fundamentally erred because they didn't understand this totalitarian nature of China, and specifically on how private property is understood in China. Could you explain a little bit more on that? Thank you.
Right. very good questions. Thank you. Yes. without understanding the nature of the regime, in particular, around the turns of the 20th and 21st century, so the Chinese, the U.S. government recognized Chinese communists having a private sector, and they thought through economic growth, through the growing of the middle class, China would eventually achieve democracy. So that was a deep belief, including the government, the business, and intellectuals. So that's the issue. So that when we talk about private property rights in China, so this is actually the most important issue and most confusions coming from there. So among economists and also legal scholars, what is the property rights actually is a debating issue. So the popular view about the property rights is is defined as a bundle of many rights. So then there is a confused belief that as long as you define all of these rights clearly, and then allowing for transactions over all of these rights, and then the issue is resolved. This is a fatal confusion. So the other concept of property rights is the ultimate control rights. So who is the person, who is the party which has the ultimate control rights over the assets? That is the essence of property rights. So if we look at issues in that angle, then it's clear, it's a crystal clear that in China, who is the agent, who is the institution which has the ultimate control over all the assets in China? The Communist Party. Why? So legally, there is a private sector. Legally, they are private owners of firms. But why you argue that the Communist Party is the ultimate owner? The reason is very simple. every entrepreneur must follow the party. And the Constitution said so. The Constitution said the party leads everything, including everybody. So taking any entrepreneur, like Jack Ma, for example, he must follow the party line. If he doesn't, if he refuses, he's going to be in trouble. So if he tries to avoid the troubles, then it's easy, follow the party line. So if everyone must follow the party line, if the party asks you to do whatever the party asks you, then you have to do it. So in that sense, who is the owner? So who has the ultimate control right? So then talking about international trade, talking about government-to-government negotiations, things like that, if people don't understand how they trade the property rights in China, on the China land, then all the negotiations start from wrong point. So only starting from understanding this, including the foreign firms, so at the someday when the party needs something, including foreign firms, you have to follow the party line. So then talking about national security, so on and so forth, geopolitics, this is the ultimate goal, ultimate objective of the party, yeah.
Maybe that's the difference between authoritarianism and totalitarianism.
Exactly.
In authoritarianism, you know, a dictator might kill you, but he's probably have some trouble preventing you from passing your property to your other family members. In totalitarianism, the party owns all property. The party owns all means of production, as they call it. And the party dictates who should own what, right? Which province should own what part and which local government own it. So in other words, there is absolutely no constitutionally guaranteed property rights. And that is the key,
right,
in my view, right?
That's
great. Next question, yeah, please.
Hi, Professor. My name is Shivan Anand. I'm with the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. Thank you for coming to speak here today. I hope this isn't getting too specific, but I just had a question on how China's totalitarianism plays a role in their Belt and Road Initiative today and their lending arm and how they plan to expand to other parts of the world, if you could share a little bit.
Right, good. Yeah, this is when we talked about United Front. This is exactly United Front. So who are the targets in this United Front strategy? So first of all, this is a grand strategy, grand geopolitical strategy. Second, this is using United Front to implement this grand strategy. So the grand strategy is to, as I mentioned earlier, that totalitarianism is expansionary. But expansionary through what channel? Not necessarily always through military occupation. So they could have better channels. So the better channel is that to control you gradually. So to form a united front with you, and then gradually you are under its control. So this is, for time's sake, I will not elaborate.
According to Lenin, since I control the time, so I can add a little bit to what you said. that's authoritarianism, not totalitarian, by the way. Lenin had this theory, it's very important, it's called the weakest link. That is, in the whole system of the world, it's become sort of a capitalist domination, and there's a strong links, such as the highly industrialized countries, United States, England, France, and Germany. So you don't really start communist revolution from those strong links. The key is to start with the weak links of the capitalist system. What are the weakest links? Well, the less developed in the countries, like China, and most of the Russia, Asia and Russia. And that's where you started your communist revolution, most likely successful. So expanding that theory, Mao had this country, his main strategy is about encircling the city through the countryside. In other words, always start with the periphery and encircling and gradually strangle the center. And this is the philosophical and ideological foundation of the Belt and Road Initiative. You started out with where the West had the least control, right? The Central Asia, and then, you know, they called the Maritime Silk Road, you know, the Indian Ocean, and of course, now expanded to Latin America and Africa. So that's the ideology behind Belt and Road Initiative. And so and it's quite successful, to be honest with you. And that's where we have to face this very important challenge. But we have to understand the fundamental reason behind the Belt and Road Initiative. It's not really for developing purposes of the poorer countries. It's part of the strategy of global domination. So with that, our time is up, and thank you very much for coming. Without a very sour note, but listen, you know, this is a very unique time, and I think, you know, we always keep our eyes on the price, and first principle, keep eyes on the fundamentals is very essential. Policy can change anytime, but there is something immutable, and that is in the genes, so to speak. And thank you very much, Professor Xu, for coming to Hudson. And also, please, buy his book.
Thank you. Thank you.